Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from Washington. We come to you every day with a podcast and radio program that aims to do two things. We will tell you about interesting and important events from around the world. And we present these reports in a way that helps you learn and improve your American English. Today we will hear more about Route 66, a famous road that once stretched across the United States. Some travelers like to call Route 66 the Mother Road. Now, Katie Weaver and Ashley Thompson tell us about some of the must-see places along the way.
Of all the strange attractions along the Mother Road, the best known is in Amarillo, Texas, Cadillac Ranch. There, 10 old Cadillac cars are partly buried, front first, in the hard, flat earth. Their back ends, several with iconic tail fins, point toward the big Texas sky. A group of artists called Ant Farm created the installation in 1974. It is on private land, but the owner has always left the area open for visitors. The installation is meant to represent the golden age of cars. Huge numbers of tourists visit Cadillac Ranch every day. Many bring along cans of spray paint. Visitors are encouraged to leave their marks on the colorful cars.
Some of the most treasured attractions on Route 66 are motels. Bright neon motel signs transport travelers back in time. These motor court-style motels became popular as the automobile rose to importance in the U.S. The small, independent motels remain a symbol of the American road trip. Along Route 66 today, the majestic Blue Swallow Motel in Tucumcari, New Mexico, stands out. The Blue Swallow opened in 1940. It has been renovated and modernized, but it still has many of the motel's classic and original features. A vintage car still sits out front. Blue Swallow's sign, though, is what makes it so special. The photogenic neon sign features a swallow, a type of bird, with a leaf in its beak. The bird's lights blink on and off. Route 66 travelers today can still stay the night in one of Blue Swallow's 12 rooms. It remains one of the most famous motels along the route.
Some of Route 66's motels are just kooky. The Wigwam Village in Holbrook, Arizona, is an example. Wigwam villages are motels built in America beginning in the 1930s. They were designed to look like traditional Native American homes. Each room is actually a separate building, tall and cone-shaped. However, that kind of native home is actually called a teepee. Native wigwams are short and round, like a dome. The builders may have gotten the name wrong, but visitors loved the motels anyway. And the wigwams remain a popular Route 66 attraction.
Winslow, Arizona is home to a relatively new attraction along Route 66. It honors a popular old song. The American group The Eagles released Take It Easy in 1972. It goes, "I'm standing on a corner in Winslow, Arizona. Such a fine sight to see." In 1999, Winslow officials opened a small public park that honors the song that made the town famous. A statue of a man holding a guitar was put up on the corner of 2nd and Kinsey Streets. A large painting on a brick wall behind the statue also depicts a line of the song with the words Winslow, Arizona painted above.
The Museum Club in Flagstaff, Arizona is a honky-tonk right along Route 66. If you are wondering what a honky-tonk is, we will get to that later. First, we will tell you about the business's original purpose. It opened in the 1930s. The owner, Dean Eldridge, built it to be the biggest log cabin in the world. Mr. Eldridge was in the taxidermy business. He placed the animals he stuffed along the walls and beams of the business and called it a museum. Later, the museum became a place to gather and drink. It also became a popular spot for travelers along Route 66. The business added country western music and dancing. Over the years, the club got wilder and rougher. Bar brawls were not uncommon. That is how the Museum Club earned its title as a honky-tonk. A honky-tonk is a bar that features country music, low-cost drinks, and wild behavior. Today, the Museum Club again is respectable, but still lively. And the taxidermied animals still hang in the club.
The El Trovatore Motel in Kingman, Arizona, opened in the late 1930s. It was once one of the most modern and expensive motels along Arizona's stretch of Route 66. It was the state's first air-conditioned motel. The area around Kingman was once a popular place to film Western movies, so Hollywood actors stayed in the area during filming. El Trovatore's past guests include Hollywood icons like Marilyn Monroe, Clark Gable, and James Dean, and El Trovatore's connection to Hollywood still remains strong today. Many of the motel rooms celebrate a different Hollywood celebrity. Guests can choose to stay in a Marilyn Monroe room, an Elvis Presley room, or a John Wayne room. Another famous El Trovatore attraction? It is now home to the world's longest Route 66 map.
Thanks to Ashley and Katie for that report on this, the first day in December. It was on December 1st in 1891 that the game of basketball was born. Basketball was the idea of a physical education teacher, American James Naismith. He wanted to create an indoor sport that could be played by his students during the winter months. And that is our program today. I'm George Grove. Thanks for joining us. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. As the population grows and temperatures rise, it will become more difficult to grow enough food for everyone. So scientists are exploring the planet for plants that do not need as much water as today's crops. The Mojave Desert in the U.S. state of California is home to some of these plants. Scientist Heather Rose Cates of the University of Florida is in that desert. She is searching along roads for a plant called the coyote melon.
We've spotted it here, growing along the ground. Nice yellow fruits.
Coyote melons are in the same plant family as butternut squash, zucchini, and pumpkins. Those vegetables are popular around the world. Ms. Cates is not collecting the coyote melon for its flavor, which she describes as terrible. She says it contains key carbetacin, which is bitter. Coyote melon may not taste good, but it can be grown in places that have had little rainfall. The desert where it grows gets just 15 to 20 centimeters of rain per year or less. Other kinds of squash need at least 2.5 centimeters per week to grow. Scientists are considering combining wild coyote melon with regular squash to see if they can make a tasty vegetable that doesn't need as much water to grow. That could be useful on a planet growing warmer and more crowded every day. Andy Jarvis works at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture.
The world is facing a real challenge in terms of food security over the next few decades.
Mr. Jarvis says farmers will need to produce 50 to 70% more food by 2050 to feed the world. So he says researchers are studying the wild versions of farm-grown crops. But he says there is a problem. He says many wild versions of farmed plants are disappearing. He says they are threatened and scientists have not collected their seeds for future use. Scientist Cates is part of an international effort to gather these plants and save their seeds while it is still possible. Workers are collecting wild oats in Cyprus, wild potatoes in Argentina, and wild peppers in Paraguay. The plants and seeds will be sent for storage to the Global Seed Vault in Norway and at Kew Gardens in Britain. Ms. Cates spends most of her time in a laboratory. She says gathering plants has helped her understand more about them.
And it's really only once you're out here looking at the wild plants, which are where our crops came from, that you get to see what they can do.
And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On July 4, 1863, a huge Confederate army surrendered at Vicksburg, Mississippi. Union forces had surrounded the city for 47 days. Food was gone. The situation was hopeless. The Confederate commander gave up. The terms of surrender were simple. The Confederate soldiers promised not to fight anymore. In return for this promise, they were released on parole and sent home to their families. Never had Union forces won such a victory. 30,000 Confederate soldiers were now out of the war. 60,000 guns and 170 cannon were now in Union hands. The Mississippi River was now under Union control. This week in our series, Larry West and Morris Joyce continue our story of the American Civil War.
The victory at Vicksburg went to General Ulysses Grant. He was named commander of all Union armies in the West. Then he was sent to Chattanooga, Tennessee. The Union army there had just been defeated in a battle along a little river called the Chickamauga. Now the Union soldiers were resting and reorganizing in Chattanooga. The Confederate line stretched halfway around the city. The Confederates had artillery on Lookout Mountain. They controlled every road into the city, except a rough one through the mountains. They had blocked the Tennessee River, above and below the city. And they had cut the railroad. The Confederate general said he would let hunger force the Union army to surrender.
Grant arrived in Chattanooga late in October. The city was full of hungry Union soldiers. They had been without supplies for almost a month. Grant wasted no time. He quickly sent troops to fight the Confederate force blocking the Tennessee River. He sent others to fight the Confederates blocking the road to the nearest Union supply center. Within 1 week, supply wagons were rolling into Chattanooga. Within a few weeks, the defeated Union army was ready to fight again.
General Grant sent his men against the middle and ends of the Confederate line at the same time. There were few Confederate soldiers at Lookout Mountain. That end of the line fell easy. The center of the line was along a low hill called Missionary Ridge. It held for a while. Then Union soldiers, acting without orders, forced their way to the top of the hill. The Confederate line broke. Southern soldiers threw down their guns and ran for their lives. The Confederate army withdrew south into the state of Georgia. Tennessee was completely in Union hands. The way was now open for the armies of the North to march into the heart of the Confederacy.
It was clear that the South could not win the war. Too many Confederate soldiers had fallen in battle. None were left to take their place. Supplies were very low. There was not enough food to eat, no shoes to wear, and little left to fight with. No one held any hope of getting supplies from outside the Confederacy. The South was circled by Union troops and warships. All seemed lost. Yet Confederate soldiers refused to stop fighting. They would not surrender. The war would not end until the Confederate armies were defeated by military force.
There was no question that the North had the military strength. Supplies were no problem. Factories were producing more than ever before. Manpower was no problem. Men continued to join the Union Army. Fewer than before, but still enough to make it a powerful force. The problem with the Union Army was its generals. Some were too careful. Some were unwilling to fight. Some did not know how to fight. The only general who seemed able to win victories was Ulysses Grant. That is why President Abraham Lincoln named Grant commander of all Union armies. Lincoln depended on him to end the Civil War.
Grant went east in March 1864, 5 months after the battle at Chattanooga. He decided to make his headquarters in the field with the Army of the Potomac. He said he would not command from an office in Washington, but he went to the city to explain his plans to President Lincoln. Grant noted that, in the past, the separate Union armies had moved and fought independently. He said they were like a poorly trained team of horses. No two of them ever pulled at the same time in the same direction. Under his command, Grant said, the Union armies would pull together. They would hit the Confederates with so much strength in so many places that the rebels could not stop them. Grant said all the armies would attack at the same time.
Grant spent the month of April preparing for the big campaign. The main target, once again, was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. The Army of the Potomac had 120,000 men. It would move against Richmond from the north. General Ben Butler had 50,000 men. He would move against Richmond from the east. General Franz Sigel would bring thousands more through the Shenandoah Valley to the northwest. These forces were three times the size of Robert E. Lee's army near Richmond. In the west, William Sherman had three armies with more than 100,000 men. His opponent, Joe Johnston, had just 60,000.
General Grant kept details of the campaign as secret as possible. Reporters asked President Lincoln when Grant would move. The president answered, "Ask General Grant." "General Grant will not tell us," said the reporters. Said Lincoln, "He will not tell me either." The final Union campaign of the Civil War began on May 3, 1864. After 2 days of marching, the Army of the Potomac reached the Wilderness. It was a thickly wooded area west of Fredericksburg, Virginia. That was where the Union Army had lost a battle to the Confederates 1 year before. That was where the two armies would fight again.
The battle quickly became a blind struggle. The woods were thick. The smoke was heavy. The soldiers could not see each other until they were very close. Shells set the trees on fire. The wounded could not escape the flames. Their screams filled the air. After 2 days, General Grant decided that the Wilderness was not the place to fight Robert E. Lee. He wanted to get around the end of Lee's army. He wanted to fight in the open, where he could use his artillery. So he began to march his men toward a place called Spotsylvania Courthouse.
Lee moved his men as fast as Grant. When the Union Army got to Spotsylvania, the Confederates were waiting behind walls of earth and stone. For several more days, the two armies fought. At times, they were so close they had no time to load and fire their guns. So they used their guns to hit each other. The Confederate line bent, but it never broke. Once again, Lee had stopped the Union Army. Grant refused to accept defeat. He said he would fight to the finish, if it took all summer. Once again, he ordered his men to march around the end of Lee's line. Lee quickly pulled his men back to a place called Cold Harbor, not far from Richmond. There they waited.
As he had done in the Wilderness and at Spotsylvania, Grant ordered his men to attack hard. It was a slaughter. In less than an hour, 7,000 Union soldiers fell dead or wounded. Grant finally stopped the attack. The Union soldiers returned to their lines. They left behind hundreds of wounded men. For 4 days, the wounded lay on the battlefield crying for help, for water. Men who tried to rescue them were shot down. Finally, Grant and Lee agreed on a ceasefire to take care of the wounded and bury the dead. It was too late for most of the wounded. They had died.
The battle at Cold Harbor ended 1 month of fighting for the Army of the Potomac. The campaign had brought it almost to the edge of Richmond, the Confederate capital. But Grant had paid a terrible price. More than 50,000 dead and wounded. Confederate losses were much lighter, about 20,000. General Grant was beginning to learn an important lesson of the war. The methods of defense had improved much more than the methods of attack.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Larry West and Morris Joyce. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at @VOALearningEnglish. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.